Where are the sunspots, and what's going to happen when they finally decide to come back? I assume they will. And what's the implications of this activity or inactivity on civilization? In a moment, Maurice Cotterell will join us as we talk about this, and nobody does it better than Maurice Cotterell. In 1989, engineer, scientist Maurice Cotterell found a way of calculating the duration of long-term magnetic reversals on the sun. Using this knowledge, he was able to break the codes of the ancient sun-worshipping civilizations. First, the Mayas of Central America, those of Tutankhamun of Egypt, the Viracochas of South America, before cracking the codes of the Terracotta Warriors of China as well. This is a special night with Maurice Cotterell. Maurice, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Always great to get you back. You know, I just was talking about a case that's going on in Minnesota where the state here in the United States, the state wants to force a family to give its child, their child, chemotherapy. He has cancer. And the parents don't want it. They want to go alternative medicine. They want to go natural. There's this big fight. You used alternative medicine and took care of your own problems, didn't you?
I did, George, yes. I think it's clearly it's up to the individuals concerned in a case like that. But I've seen an excellent program made by a lady called Dr. Lorraine Day. And she had cancer, and she cured herself using homeopathic techniques rather than chemicals and ionizing radiation. And that was because, as a medical doctor, she knew that chemotherapy and ionizing radiations actually do cause cancer. So, yes, I'm a great advocate of natural healing, let me put it that way. And as you say, I was quite ill myself for, well, good heavens, I came to Ireland about 8 years ago, and I began to notice that my eyes were watering. So I don't know if you've got time to talk about this.
No, of course. You're with us 3 hours, Maurice. You're not going anywhere.
Okay, it's a very interesting and fascinating disease, and I'm sure half of your listeners have got it, but they don't know it. So that's why, I'd like to just take a diversion slightly. And, what happened was when I came to Ireland, my eyes started to water quite a lot. So I went to the doctors, and they said, well, it's hay fever. And I said, what, in December? So they sent me away. About a year later, I started to get white lumps on the tops of my eyelids. And I went to the doctor, and they said, oh, high cholesterol. I said, high cholesterol? I said, well, let's check it out. So they checked it out. It was normal. So I said, well, what's causing these? He said, well, some people get them. And that was the end of that. About a year later, I started to get severe backache in my lower back, excruciating pain. And I just couldn't figure it out. So I went back to the doctor. I said, look, I need to have some tests. I need to be checked out. So he sent me to the hospital, and they performed about 20 tests. They checked everything from the back end and everything from the mouth downwards. He said, 20 tests, they're all fine. And then I noticed that I'd always had flu all of my life. I seemed to be susceptible to two bouts of flu a year. And they usually were sorted out by going to bed, taking it easy for a few days, and it went away. What I began to notice now when I look back was about 10 years ago, I started to get them more frequently, three or four a year. And so I tried experimenting, and I took antibiotics, and this so-called flu disappeared. Well, of course, we all know that antibiotics are not affected, cannot affect a virus. So it wasn't flu. So anyway, on one of these occasions, I went back to the GP about 10 years ago, and I said, look, the old flu's back. Could I have some antibiotics? And he said, well, we've taken a blood test last week. He said that the blood's normal. There's no infection. Therefore, antibiotics will be of no use to you, so I'm not going to give them to you. I said, but, I know that if you don't give them to me, this backache will turn into a fever. Then I'll get feverish and start shivering and shaking. Then I'll get delirium, and it's very unpleasant. He said, well, I'm not going to give them you antibiotics. Well, as it happens, I had a few left over, and I was going to Mexico. So when I got to Mexico, I bought about 10 boxes to keep me going. Anyway, my question then began. The question for me was, when is an infection not an infection? Because the doctor was saying, I've not got an infection, but clearly antibiotics did get rid of whatever it was that was killing me. So I had to think about it, and of course it went away, and the pressure went off, and it came back a couple of years later, and I thought about it again, and then it brings me back to Ireland, going back a few years now. And I decided to get on the internet and try to figure out when an infection is not an infection, when antibiotics could possibly bring me back from the brink of death, because these episodes got worse and worse. Until about 4 years ago, when I took to bed, the rest didn't clear it. The rest did not clear whatever I was suffering from, and it escalated. My lungs began to get pains, my liver got pains, my heart got pains, and then I got very delirious. And if I didn't have antibiotics, I suspect I would have been dead. And it was very curious, because when I say antibiotics, I don't mean 2 weeks of antibiotics. I mean one antibiotic tablet. If I swallowed one antibiotic tablet or two, I started to recover from the brink of death to normal health.
That's amazing.
Absolutely amazing. So I got on the net, and, 5 years ago, there wasn't too much on the net. But eventually, in fact, George, this is remarkable. If it wasn't for this disease, I would never have discovered how gravity works.
You're going to have to explain that one.
Okay, well, perhaps later.
Okay.
Anyway, I got on the web, and I thought, well, maybe the iron in the well water in Ireland, it's got too much iron in it, and maybe I've got a disease called hemochromatosis, which is the Irish disease. They call it the Celtic disease, because Irishmen get it. And apparently the Irish have a susceptible gene for this iron overload. Now, women don't get it, because they lose more blood, and they lose the iron in the blood. So it's very much a disease contracted by males in Ireland. So I got on the web, and I thought, perhaps it's hemochromatosis. So I went to see, I had a test, and I said, have I got the gene for hemochromatosis? And she said, no. So I thought, well, okay, I'll go back, and I'll try and take the iron out of the well water. So I got some magnetron magnets from radar sets, and I put them across. I put them across the water filters to try to catch the iron in the well water,
as much as you could, right?
As much as I could. There was already particle filters in there, down to about 10 microns, but not actual iron molecule filters, which you can't get, by the way. They're very expensive, and that's why I tried it this way first.
Yeah.
So I put the magnets across, very, very strong magnets, and at the end of the month, I checked the iron in the bottom of the bucket, and it was just not magnetic. None of the magnetic particles, none of the iron particles would stick to the magnet. So I thought, well, that's interesting. What's so special about iron that when it's in water, it ceases to become magnetic? And I started to study the properties of iron, and I realized that it was an isotope, one of the few non-radioactive isotopes. And an isotope is an unbalanced atom. And in the case of iron, they have 32 positive charges in the middle. 32 neutral charges in the middle, and only 26 positive ones and 26 negative ones. So there are more positives than negative. So I sat down with this information, and it didn't take me long at all to figure out how permanent magnetism worked. And it was from there that I went on to figure out how gravity works.
That's amazing.
If anybody would like to know, then they can look at my website, and there's a paper there they can download. Anybody can understand it. It's interesting and it's fascinating, and that's the story behind how I actually got to where I did.
Well, see, I think people should have the right to decide what they want to do for themselves, Maurice.
Well, it's not a question of sometimes deciding. There's nobody else to help you. You've got to help yourself.
Yes, you do.
You get to a stage where the doctors look at you as though you're completely stupid. And, I went to see what I can only describe as a psychopath at the local hospital in October last year, at the low point of when I was dying. In fact, it was so bad, I called up the solicitors, I rewrote my will, and I made arrangements for a burial plot. That was in October last year.
My God.
That's how sick I was. And I tried to cure this thing without antibiotics, and it was killing me. It was awful. I wouldn't wish anybody to go there. The pain was absolutely horrendous.
Look, we have lost way too many coast-to-coast guests to very strange deaths and deaths, so we don't want to lose you, Maurice.
Well, this one, George, is absolutely fascinating. This disease, I'm telling you, and I'm convinced that half the people listening, as I said earlier, to this show have got it in various degrees. Mine was just an extreme case, perhaps because I'm very, very sensitive. But I got on the net, and I found some information from a doctor in New York called Dr. Leo Galland. G-A-L-L-A-N-D, and he's the leading expert in this particular disease. And he calls it leaky gut disease. It's when the small intestine begins to leak poisons into the bloodstream. And I suspected it must be the small intestine because it was the only part of the body that hadn't been tested. They tested the large intestine, which is a one-inch piece of tubing inside the digestive system. They tested the stomach, but they hadn't tested the bit in between, the small intestine, which is really the fuel tank of the body. When you eat your food, the stomach turns it to mud simply to pump it around the body. It turns it into a liquid, and then after it goes from the stomach, it goes into the small intestine, where all the goodness is taken out of the food, and that gives you the energy to live and walk about. So once that goes wrong, it's like the car with no fuel. You go downhill rapidly. Yes, it's hours. You know, once that small intestine, you have a problem with that, you're in trouble. So Dr. Leo Galland gave me a good rendition of what leaky gut disease was and how it was caused and so on, and the homeopathic routines for getting out of it. Now, I'd suffered from irritable bowel disease for years, or they call it IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, because they can't figure out, again, what's causing it. And again, doctors dismiss it as harmless. It's not harmless, it's a killer. Now, in my case, I now understand the mechanism. Most people get it from two different ways. One is through chlorine in the water supply. Chlorine kills the good bacteria in the small intestine.
In your gut, right.
In your gut. And your gut becomes unbalanced and inflamed. And once it's inflamed, then you're in trouble. You get irritable bowel syndrome, which is you keep going to the toilet and so on, and you lose strength and energy because you're not absorbing the nutrients from the food as well as you should do. Another way of catching it is through alcohol. Alcohol is a disinfectant, so if you drink lots of strong alcohol, the alcohol will kill the gut bacteria. But neither of those applied to me. The reason I had caught it over the years, I figured out, was through stress, and I worked out the mechanism of what was actually going on. When we're stressed, we're afraid. We might be afraid that we're not going to pass an examination. We might be afraid we're not going to meet a deadline for a project, or afraid for 101 reasons.
Or your lifestyle, events, your relationships, who knows what.
Absolutely. Now, what happens when we're afraid, George? When you walk down the street and somebody comes out to mug you, you're afraid. What happens? The adrenaline flows.
That kicks in.
That kicks in. Now, the adrenaline is very interesting because it allows you to either fight or run, the fight or flight response. If you decide to fight, you need all the energy. So what the adrenaline does is empties the bowels. This is why, you know, when people are very afraid, we get, excuse the expression, but it's the one that's used, we tend to shit ourselves because we're very afraid. And that's synonymous with being terrified. Now, what happens is, once you defecate like that, you stop the energy being sucked out of your body by the small intestine, because it takes a lot of energy to digest that food. That's why we fall asleep after we've eaten a large meal. So once all that's out of your body, you're allowed to run away or fight. It gives you more energy, and that's what it's all about. So with the adrenaline also irritates the bowel, as well as alcohol and as well as chlorine. If you have too much adrenaline, it will inflame the small intestine. It will lead to irritable bowel syndrome. And again, the inside of the small gut will get red raw and inflamed. And it will start to, it's not so much crack, it begins to leak small particles of food through the cracks, and also poisons from the bacteria in your gut, because we go to the toilet, but the bacteria inside you also go to the toilet. And when they go to the toilet, they give off tremendous poisons called toxins. In fact, they're called exotoxins when they're in the gut. Now, two things happen once that mechanism's kicked in and half the population have got irritable bowel syndrome, don't forget. The first thing is, when the food goes through, your body thinks that they're bacteria and tries to kill them and flush them away. Your body produces histamine. Now, histamine, this is what happens when you have a cold. You have a virus. The histamine kicks in, tries to flush the virus out of your nose. The same thing happens when you've got leaky gut disease. The food leaks through your bowel. You produce histamine. As soon as you produce histamine, it makes it worse, because histamine thins out the blood vessels, so it thins out your gut. So then the cracks get bigger. So more food leaks through. Your eyes start to water. You think you've got hay fever, but you're allergic to everything you eat. And that's what's so interesting about it. The next thing is the toxins from the bacteria leak through. The liver tries to dump them and get rid of them out of the bloodstream and throws them into the muscles in the small of the back. And you get terrific backache in the small of your back and the muscles. Then it gets insidious, because then after about 2 weeks, the liver can't empty any more toxins out of the blood. And it starts to dump them in the liver, the lungs, the heart, and the brain. And you die through blood poisoning, which is called toxemia.
And then you probably could go pretty darn fast, Maurice.
It's remarkable and very interesting, because then what happens, George, is toxemia, it's like filthy blood. It's dirty blood. It's so full of poison.
Well, I'm glad you survived. Anyways, let's get into the sunspots story. Whoa. Tell me about your work here with sunspots.
Well, it started for me many years ago, George, when I was on board ship as a radio officer in the Merchant Navy. And I noticed that when the ship was sailing from north to south, the crew were quite happy and settled. But when we were sailing from east to west, people got very agitated and argued a lot. And I became very interested in why this should be, why the ship's course should affect the behavior of the people on board. And I also became interested in astrology and personalities, because we were in a very confined space, and it was an opportunity to study the people whose birthdays I was aware of, because I had all the information in front of me in the event of problems on board, next of kin, we needed all the birthdays and so on. So I started to do some research into personalities and behavior and what mechanism might be causing people to behave differently as we go from north to south and east to west. And of course, if we go from east to west, we get jet lag. And if we go from north to south, we don't get jet lag. And this is all to do with melatonin and the generation of hormones in the blood.
That's interesting.
So I got into this. This would be about 1970, so we're going back 40 years now. And I traveled the world, and I went to India and China and Burma, and I visited the temples, and I got very interested in the spiritualism of those nations. And I had my palm read. I went to palmists, and again, I was very interested in how a palm could possibly tell the same story from country to country. As I visited all these different people, they all told me, this was at the age of 16, 18, 19, 20, and so on, that I would write many books, and that that lots and lots of things. They would tell me everything that was going to happen over the next 30 or 40 years. So I became fascinated in, excuse me, the esoteric side of life.
Get yourself a little glass of water there, Maurice.
Excuse me, Jim.
All right. Well, he's going to take a little glass of water and
thank you.
Right back. You okay now?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. All right.
So on one occasion, the ship sailed south to South Africa, and I was having a terrific problem trying to communicate with London from South Africa. We used to use shortwave transmissions in those days. And it was the sunspot maximum. And when the sun's very active, we call them sunspots, when it's got lots of brown spots on the sun. We know it's magnetic.
And it's not active now.
It's not active now, and I'm quite happy to explain why. It's all very, very straightforward and very interesting again. What I noticed was that every 11 and a half years, the sun becomes very active. We know this by looking at the number of spots on the sun. When there's more spots, it's more active. When it's less spots, it's less magnetically active. And it disrupts the sky. It disrupts the ionosphere and the ozone layer. It disrupts the layers of ions that reflect radio waves. Radio waves are reflected off the sky, if you like, back to Earth. And it makes it very difficult to communicate. We get fading, you know, signals fade, they come and go, and all sorts of strange effects. So when I went to China, I then got interested in the 12-year astrological cycle of the Chinese. And I thought, well, I wonder if the 12-year cycle's got anything to do with the 11-and-a-half-year sunspot cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started to really start researching into the sun, how the sun affects life on Earth, the physics of the sun, and really my life opened up. It was like somebody switching the light on. Once I understood the sun, it became clear that previous civilizations had understood the sun. And that raised a few interesting questions, because I thought, well, how could they have known what I have been researching all those years ago.
And that would include the Mayans as well. We'll be back with Maurice Cotterell in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you sign up for Streamlink, just pennies a day, you'll be able to get podcasting and downloads as well. Just go to coasttocoastam.com and click the link there to sign up for Streamlink. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Maurice Cotterell now as we talk about the sun, its inactivity and activity. Back to the lack of sunspots, Maurice. I mean, scientists are baffled now, aren't they, about where these sunspots are?
They may be baffled, but I'm not, George.
No. Well, I mean, you study the sun.
Of course. And in fact, in this month's issue of Science magazine in America, there's some articles on the Messenger NASA spacecraft that's taking pictures of Mercury right now.
Right.
And in fact, there's a report that in January 2008, they surveyed the surface and there was no magnetic field on Mercury. And they surveyed it again in just last October, that would be 10 months later, and they had a massive magnetic field 10 times stronger than the Earth's. And this is what I've been trying to tell Coast to Coast listeners for years. What's happening is, I'll just explain the sunspot mechanism to listeners.
Okay.
What happens is the sun itself has a large magnetic field going from the North Pole to the South Pole, just like the Earth does. And the planet Mercury orbits very closely to the sun. And the magnetic field of Mercury tends to grab hold of this magnetic field, which is going from north to south, like an elastic band, and it wraps it around the sun. And the sun becomes very tight and starts to burst out with pockmarks, if you like, sunspots, we call them.
Huh.
And the intensity of the magnetic field coming off these sunspots rises about 4,000 or 5,000 times its normal level. So the question is, how can sunspots stop? Because we know they stop every 11 years. Or 11 and a half.
Right.
Years.
You would think that it would happen all the time, right?
Exactly. Of course you would, because Mercury doesn't stop.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, what's actually happening is that when the sun's magnetic field reverses, it has an effect on Mercury's magnetic field. It tries to suppress Mercury's magnetic field. This is what I believe, because it's opposite. It can't be in one 11-year period, if the magnetic field of the sun is north-south, then what will happen is Mercury's magnetic field, like a compass needle, will come into line with that. And it does this over thousands of years, not just 11 years. Now, if that magnetic field of the sun reverses, Mercury can't just reverse because of the way the magnetic field is generated inside Mercury, which is a very similar way to how it's generated inside the Earth. Mercury is about 70% iron and holds a magnetic field very readily, but loses a magnetic field very readily. Iron is very easy to magnetize, but it loses its magnetic field easily. And it's all about understanding the mechanism of the Earth's magnetic field and how it's generated, and Mercury's magnetic field and how it's generated. And I was not in a position to understand that until I figured out gravity just a few months ago. And again, it's on my website if people would like to look at that. Now, what's actually happening is, when the sun's magnetic field changes, it influences the flowing magma inside Mercury. Mercury generates more heat. The solid core of Mercury melts. So instead of having a molten ring of molten magma circulating around a solid core, mm-hmm. generating a magnetic field, the solid core melts and Mercury loses its magnetic field, which is what the spacecraft Messenger discovered in January 2008.
Okay, so we have to assume that's what's happening now,
that's
right?
That's right. That's exactly what's happening now. But, of course, in October, it's increased now to 10 times that value. So what's happened is since January 2008, Mercury has cooled down, the core has rehardened, the magnetic field has reestablished, and it's still in the same direction. It's just that it's cooled down again now. The magma is still flowing in the same direction. That's because of the planet's rotation.
Do you think Mercury's core then historically melts, hardens?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And the reason it does this is because the only reason we've got a solid core on the Earth is because of the pressure of all the rocks. The size of the Earth is so large, all the gravitational pressure is pressing on the inside of the planet. So as the temperature gets hotter inside the planet, due to gravitational heating, gravity heats up the planet, you would expect the middle to be the hottest, which it is, but because the pressure's a lot higher, it doesn't melt. If you wish to boil water and you increase the pressure, you have to boil it to a higher temperature, if you like, get the temperature higher. And if you go to Mount Everest, water will boil at a lower temperature because the pressure's less. So it's all to do with temperature and pressure. It's a balance. So
Go ahead.
So definitely, it's the resolidification of the Mercurian core. Now, Mercury is very tiny. It's only about 25% bigger than the Moon. So we don't get this fluctuating melting of the Earth's core very often. We can get it under exceptional circumstances, but we don't normally get it under normal conditions. And so Mercury being so much smaller, the pressure's so much less, and therefore Mercury is very elastic. It flips from one state to another very, very easily. And once the core rehardens, then it starts to regenerate a magnetic field, and it starts to rewind up the sun's magnetic field, and again we get a new cycle of sunspots for 11 and a half years.
Interesting.
And it's not just the 11 and a half years. The sun's magnetic field shifts direction five times every 18,139 years. And this is what the ancient sun-worshipping civilizations understood. They understood this mechanism.
How did they understand this, though, Maurice? They didn't have any kind of technological equipment or anything.
No, they didn't. But the leaders were very, very switched on people. For example, you can say the same question about... I'll ask you exactly the same question, George, as what you've just asked me. How did Jesus walk on the water? He didn't have any special equipment, did he? How did Jesus heal the sick with his bare hands? He didn't have any special MRI scanners or X-rays or whatever. And he did it because we would regard it as miracles. He was a miracle maker. Now, the leader of the sun-worshipping civilizations were all miracle makers. The leader of the Mayas was called Lord Peikau. He was a miracle maker. He was a priest king leader of the Mayans. And he was the son of God, just like Jesus. His name was Peikau. Peikau is the Roman Catholic word for Easter. It's derived from the word Passover. In Ireland, lots of people are called Pascal because they're born around Easter time. That's their Christian name. And what we find is Tutankhamun was another one, another sun-worshipping leader. Tutankhamun means the son of God, just like Jesus is the son of God. When Mary was about to have her child, the angel came down and said to Mary, "You shall have a son. His name will be Jesus. Chi Zeus. Chi is godly energy in Tibet. Chi. And Zeus is God, the creator God. Chi Zeus, the son of God." Hmm. Now, all of these sun-worshipping civilizations understood the sun because they understood how to walk on water, how to turn water into wine, how to heal the sick with their bare hands. They knew, they understood science, they understood the periodic table, they understood the elements. They understood that the Earth and everything in it is carbon-based, with the carbon atom is 6 electrons, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, 666, the mark of the beast, the mark of the animal, living flesh. They worship the number 999 being the corollary of 666. 999 was the number of a god or a super god. And this is why they used to paint the tombs with cinnabar. Red cinnabar is the powdered form of the metal mercury, and cinnabar has a periodic number of 80. It's got 80 electrons, protons, and neutrons. So if you bury somebody in a box painted in cinnabar, that person becomes number 81. It's one more on top of the cinnabar, and 81 is 9999999, the number of God. This is why the Chinese leader... good heavens, his name escapes me for the moment. It'll come back to me. In the pyramids of Xi'an in China, was buried in a lake of mercury because this tells us he was a super god. He was one of these spiritual leaders that understood the super science of the sun and understood the tenets of spirituality, why we're born, why we die, and why this has to be. And all of this stuff is connected. And what better way to explain to primitive people like ourselves but to use science. And by using science, they say, look, this is how clever we are. We understand the science that you're only just beginning to learn. We understood this science thousands of years ago. You know, listen to us. We're cleverer than you. When we say that you are a soul, a living being, a part of God, that you are light energy, that's what you really are. You are God in disguise. Every living thing is God in disguise, whether it's a flower or a bird or a frog or a human being. And when you die, you leave that body behind, and your God inside returns to where it came from. It goes back to heaven. And the universe gets, God gets bigger and bigger as our soul now, leaves our body.
Now, these ancient civilizations, though, they were they able to, with pinpoint accuracy, predict some of these events on the sun, for example? I mean, surely they could not see sunspots, right?
They could see sunspots. You can project it onto a piece of paper.
And see a little mark there or something?
Well, they did have lenses. They used lenses of cow's eyes and things like that.
Okay.
And they used bits of glass, and you can project it onto paper. But more than that, they understood the heavens because we are spiritual beings. And yes, they could make predictions. Absolutely. They knew they were going to die around AD 700 to 750 when the sunspot cycle was at a minimum. And that happens for various reasons. When the sunspots stop every few thousand years, not just 11 years, when it stops, there are three sunspot cycles. This is the problem. This is an 11 and a half year sunspot cycle. There's a longer one which takes 187 years. These two cycles mix together to give us an 18,139 year cycle. So, and during that 18,000 year cycle, the sun's magnetic field shifts five times. This also affects Mercury. Every time the sun's field changes, it affects Mercury. So sunspots change every 11 and a half years, Mercury changing Mercury's magnetic field, and they change every few thousand years. And they encoded all these numbers. For example, they knew that the sun's magnetic field changed every 3,740 years. And so they knew that that period after the beginning of their calendar would cause them to die away. Now, their calendar began in 3113 BC, and they knew they would die out around AD 700. And they did. They all died, for the most part. There was a few left behind. For the most part, they died out for three reasons. Because when we get no sunspots, we get a reduction in the production of estrogen and progesterone in the brains of females. So we get decreased fertility on Earth. We have a shortage of babies. The second effect is we get a mini ice age. The reason for this is, we believe, is that because when you get more sunspots, you get more particles. If you can imagine this, charged particles, clouds of them, over the sun. Now, if the sun's cloudy, not as much sunshine reaches the Earth.
Right.
Now, if you have a sunspot minimum, you get less clouds on the sun, so more sunshine reaches the Earth. And if more sunshine reaches the Earth, more water evaporates from the ocean, more clouds develop on Earth, and we get a mini ice age. So the temperatures fall. So there's an inverse effect between solar activity.
Which is, again, what we're in now, right?
Which is exactly what we're in now. And again, when it comes to global warming, we have to take all of these factors into consideration. It's no good imagining that man-made CO2 is the only determining factor of global warming. Because if I can just digress onto global warming...
I'm glad to hear you say that, though, because I've been saying for years now that we're in cycles. It's not just man.
Absolutely. And... Emmanuel Velikovsky had the most sensible stuff to say on this topic, at least for me, because he couldn't figure out how we had ice ages at all. He scratched his head. He said, it's all a bit perplexing to me, because if you think about it, if temperatures get warmer, then the ice caps should melt. That's straightforward enough.
Right, right.
Okay, so but if temperatures get colder, then there'll be less evaporation of water from the oceans. There'll be less rain and less snow.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's less rain and less snow, how can the ice caps grow?
Good point.
So it's impossible.
Good point.
If you get
it
your head
impossible.
Around it, it's impossible to have an ice age. And yet we know from studies of ice cores and so on that over the years we've had ice ages where the Earth has been enveloped in ice. Now, we've got to address this. You know, we can't just say, oh, it's CO2. Now, Velikovsky said, you know, if you think about it, the only way we can have an ice age on that basis is if the Earth heated up from inside. Because then the oceans would get warm and boil, mm-hmm. and the extra steam would fall as rain and snow, and the ice caps would grow. So he said, how can we get the planet to heat up from within? And of course, he didn't have the science in the 1950s. He didn't know that the sun's magnetic field changed direction. When it changed direction, it tilted the molten magma inside the Earth, and then that created extra heat. So now we understand why. I mean, we're trying to put the cart before the horse. We're
absolutely
trying to say,
brilliant.
You know, we're trying to say, how can ice ages occur, or how can global warming work? And we don't even understand how gravity works. We're putting the cart before the horse. Look, you can't understand how global warming works until you understand how gravity works. You can't understand how gravity works until you understand how the sun, how the Earth can possibly heat up from within, and how the Earth became hot in the first place. How did the Earth become hot in the first place? We get these idiotic graphics on TV showing two planets smashing into each other billions of years ago, glowing red hot, which is not what happens. It defies the laws of physics. If two cars smash into each other, they don't glue themselves together and glow red hot. They smash into lots of pieces and cool down. So we've got to figure out the heating mechanism of the Earth first. Then we figure out how the heating mechanism affects the Earth's magnetic field. Then we figure out how the Earth's magnetic field can be affected by the sun's magnetic field. Then we figure out how the sun affects the Earth's magnetic field, how it affects the temperature of the core can melt, how the magnetic field can decay, and how ice ages occur. That's the way to address these problems.
Why doesn't science look at some of this? I mean, it would be so obvious, even if your theories were wrong, at least to look at that. Why don't they do that?
I think it's because they're ego-driven. We have different, you know, I'm here on this Earth to make the Earth a better place. That's always been my view. Now, most of the scientists come up through the system. I didn't come up through the orthodox system of education like most people. That's just not the way it happened. I mean, I could go into it, but I don't want to digress that much. I did it my own way. I educated myself. I taught myself. I got my degrees myself. Now, most of these guys, they grow up through school, they do as they're told, they don't answer questions. If they do answer questions, they're pilloried. I ask questions all my life. I was trying to figure out why things happened, how a bird with the size of a brain the size of a pea could fly through the branches of a tree at 100 miles an hour. It seemed to me that a bird must be very clever, and yet it defeated logic, the fact that its brain was so small it wouldn't allow that sort of processing to go on. And I used to ask questions at school. I remember one question I asked was, if we drilled a hole all the way through the Earth and dropped a stone into it, what would happen to it? Would it come out in Australia and go to the sky in Australia and come back? And I was told, don't be stupid. We can't drill a hole through the Earth. And all my life I was asking questions like that. And it seemed to me that the only way I'm going to sort these questions out was for myself. And so, being spiritually predisposed, I addressed the religious questions first. What is God?
Right.
And it seemed to me that, I don't argue with what the ancients have written. The ancients told us that God is light. So I'm not going to argue with that. These people are cleverer than I am. And so I thought, well, if God is light, and I've been taught that light is electromagnetic energy, it's reasonable to assume that God is electromagnetic energy. God is a voltage. So if I put voltage into my computer, if I put God into my computer comes alive. If I unplug my computer from the voltage, my computer dies. When I put God into my computer, I get all sorts of miracles. I can see the planet Venus. I can see elephants. I can listen to telephone calls. As soon as I put God into my computer, electromagnetic energy, it can perform miracles. And once we start bringing science and religion together instead of fighting it, then we have a hope of finding out the answers. Because we can't figure out, you know, just last week I figured out it's not possible to have a big bang. We have to have two big bangs. And that changes, again, the way we think. And I figured out last week why the atom has eight shells in it.
I want to talk with you about the big bang when we come back, Maurice. In addition to this cycle, this minimum, are we coming out of it? And if we are, what's going to happen? We'll be back.